Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm delighted to welcome to this session as our special guest, Brian Weezer, Global President, Business Intelligence Group M. Did I get your job title right there, Brian?
And the name too.
I reckon that's quite straightforward. Do people really get your name wrong?
Actually, only about a third of the time unprompted.
Really? Interesting.
A third of the time do they get it correct? I mean, yeah, the E versus I versus E thing is
messed up. Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, okay, well done me. I passed the first hurdle of the day. And, of course, our regular podcast guest, the other half of the duo, the dynamic duo, which is me and Lindsay Rowntree, head of content. Hello, Lindsay.
Hi. And I have to say, on getting Brian's name right, like, that is literally a massive win for you because you are chronically terrible at people's names. Like, it is hilarious.
I mean, honestly, Lindsay, don't give this away. I was kind of hoping that people just don't really notice. But no,
I hope people have noticed.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Okie dokie. Since I'm on a roll, let's get cracking with the first news story of the day that I wanted to chat with the two of you about. A couple of pieces came out around the start of, I suppose, what you could call earnings season's reports. And two reports I wanted to pick up on. The first is that Snap reported their results for Q1, and they exceeded expectations in terms of revenue and also user numbers. And I suppose, unsurprisingly, they were also able to report quite a spike in daily time spent on the platform. So, you know, reported revenue was 460 million USD, exceeding expectations of 430 million. User numbers were up to 229 million, where they'd anticipated 224.5. And daily time spent on the platform growing 35% year on year. I guess that's not, the sort of growth in daily user numbers, daily time spent in user numbers maybe isn't that much of a surprise, but I sort of feel like the spike in revenue suggests that they're not yet feeling any impact from a reduction in advertising spend. And I want to hear what you two think about that. But coupled together with that, in terms of earnings from Q1, I also wanted to note Netflix's results for Q1. A huge growth in subscriber numbers. Again, not really unsurprising in this particular landscape. Growing the user numbers by 15.8 million in this quarter. The significant portion of that growth coming from EMEA with 7 million, and then APAC next with 3.6 million, then LATAM with 2.9 million and about 2.3 in North America. So still following that trajectory of them not necessarily growing their figures significantly within the US, but more looking to those international markets for that growth. But they really made a point in releasing the sort of press releases around their Q1 numbers to say that, in their opinion, this is a boost, which is temporary, and it's as a result of everybody being in global lockdown measures and consuming more at home. And they also made a point of noting that the revenue hasn't really been boosted at quite the same rate, you know, partly to do with a strong US dollar, which is obviously having an impact on their kind of international revenue, but also because where they've reduced marketing spend, they've simply replaced that with tech and development spend. So I thought two quite interesting Q1 results reports. Brian, I want to go to you first to hear your perspective on this.
Yeah, well, starting with Snap, I think, and let me preface what I'm about to say by noting that I think they have done well as an organization, turning themselves around in terms of making themselves a viable part of the media plan for many of the world's largest marketers, and they're doing reasonably well in expanding to other segments. With that noted, now let's keep in mind expectations basically are guidance, right? It's analyst's interpretation of a range of guidance. So to some degree, we need to be mindful that bar for expectations is something that the company in large part sets based on what they already know is going to happen. Now they had what they thought was a really good and even better than expectations, meaning guidance, January and February, but the wheels fell off after that. And that's where I think that anyone looking at Snap needs to focus, because the delta, the growth rate between the first 2 months of the quarter, which were, for lack of a better word, normal, and the first 19 days of April, which they provided color on, which was about 15% growth. That's about a 40% delta. They did, I forget the numbers, high 50s in January and February, and 15 in, you know, April. So that is an impact from the downturn. So there's underlying doing the right things, supporting their business and all that, but they're facing the same headwind that I think that most of the industry will, and digital advertising in particular, will face, because again, an advertiser needs to claw back money can do so from digital pretty easily. And the short-term demand that might otherwise have popped up won't really be there. So I think that the positive interpretations that came out of earnings were probably overdone. I mean, there are reasons to have been positive about Snap coming into the quarter, but I think in terms of where they are this year, they are going to struggle like a lot of media owners will. The other thing is with the time spent metrics they provide were interesting. I mean, I did a crude calculation myself. You know, the data they provided was pretty limited. It's not useful to know what the growth of consumption was, towards the end of March over January, February, which is what they, I think, were talking about. It's not unlike saying that, in the United States, you know, pumpkin futures have been rising all the month of October. I think they're going to peak right around December. Simpsons reference, if you remember. So just because they're sequentially inside of a year doing well doesn't necessarily tell you anything. You want to know the year-over-year trend. The other metric they provided that, again, we need to be cautious around was they talked up Discover with and provide some numbers that sounded good. But again, we need context. We need better context when we get numbers like this, because they said, I think they provide some great data on how 35 plus audiences are consuming Discover. Arguably, this is where some of the greatest opportunities should be for large brands who want to be around premium or similar to premium content. And they don't want, there's relatively few advertisers that actually want under 34s or under 35s. So that growth sounded good, but the problem is we don't know what percentage of total consumption, total time on the platform that Discover represents. That's the first thing. The second thing is, well, they don't tell us how many people are 35 plus. They do tell us that in the United States that 75% of people between the ages of 13 and 34 are on the platform. They tell us their total North America users of 88 million. You can infer there's 80 million in the US. If you calculate that 75% of 13 to 34s, that gets you to 73 million. And if nobody under the age of 13 is on the platform, because of course nobody under the age of 13 could possibly be using digital media, as we all know, right? that would leave you at most 7 million 35 pluses, or about 4% of the population, for an indeterminate amount of time, probably a minority of the consumption. Is it meaningful? I mean, we don't know. We don't have enough data. So I it's not to say they're not doing well. I just caution overreading into what they provided, because we got some snippets, but not a lot. That said, by the way, I think they're doing really well. Their new hire, Peter Naylor, I think is one of the favorite people in the industry for a lot of us. So good for them getting him. Maybe on Netflix, I guess I'd add, the more specific comment that they at least that I took away was that they thought they were pulling forward demand that would otherwise have, you know, shown up later. More than, again, that was my interpretation of the comments, more than that they were saying that this was a bump that would go away. It's more that they pulled forward demand. But that said, I was amused by their very, you know, pretty honest characterization that even when they were talking about the next quarter, they said, well, it's really just a guess. We don't actually have a good idea. Yeah. It was very accurate to characterize it that way. But I think that, what's not in the data that they provide is, again, arguably more useful to understand what's going on. You know, when we look at, we can get more granular data in the U.S. from Nielsen, and we can see that consumption of streaming services collectively is up by, 50, 60% during this period of lockdown. And we can see that, we're seeing a near doubling of consumption in any given week. It's really quite impressive. So total TV consumption is up a lot. Streaming is up much more, and SVOD services more than that. So that's not in the data that Netflix provided, but it does give an indication of, you know, the degree to which people are probably relying on them during this point in time. That won't sustain itself when in a back to work environment. However, a normal back to work environment could be a long time away still.
Totally. And we don't really know what that normal back to work environment might look like. Like there is, you know, a possibility that the new normal might still include a lot more time spent at home, you know, even in 12 months time to come, lockdown and restrictions aside. Plenty of subsequent questions I want to point to you there, but I'm going to go to Lindsay to get her point of view. Specifically, you know, I suppose just initially looking at those Snap results, I was thinking, is this an example of where, you know, firstly, they hadn't necessarily felt entirely the heat of a downturn in advertising revenue, although, as you point out, if you dig into the numbers a bit deeper, you can start to see it there. But I wondered if it would provide an example of where advertisers might go, you know, for those advertisers who are still feeling like they, you know, like that they've got money to invest and that they need to sort of sustain and keep their visibility up during this particular period. You know, I'll come back to you on that. Lindsay, give us your perspective first on the Snap and Netflix results.
Yeah, I think so. It's always tough to come back on earned results when you're following Brian, because obviously he lives and breathes this stuff. But I mean,
yeah, sorry about that, Lindsay.
Yeah, thanks very much. Way to show me up, bloody hell. But the interesting thing that Brian said was actually around the Discover platform on Snap and the subsequent age ranges that Snap are talking about, the fact that are using their platform, and your crude calculations about the fact that, you know, 4% of the population is what I would refer you to call like a marketable audience for advertisers that would want to be looking at Snap as a viable place to maintain their brand visibility during these unprecedented times. And that is the interesting thing, because basically that means there's no one on Snap that's really of any value for an advertiser that doesn't have much budget and is really cautious about where their budget goes. They likely aren't going to look at Snap for that kind of visibility when there are other platforms that are able to draw those audiences in. And I feel like that those tiny volume of a few million US people over the age of 34 that are looking at the premium content on Snap, which is the Discover platform, is a bit similar to me downloading TikTok, which I have actually now done. And just kind of toying with it and looking at it alongside a million other things they would never normally have looked at. But it's just that there's not your usual places to get content are now not enough for you during a normal day. So you're going to other places. So you might then look at Snap as an extra place where I haven't read something on Snap for a while. Oh, wait, it's the same story I just read over there and the same news I just read over there. I think they're just trying to find new sources of content, but probably won't be finding very much. And so won't be engaging with the platform in the way that the Snap would probably want them to. And as such, will not be an engaged user when it comes to an advertiser wanting to put their money there. And anyone below that, as Brian obviously said, you know, is not necessarily going to be the right audience for a lot of these advertisers at the moment. So it feels like the opportunities with Snap, it's difficult, because most companies, and Netflix did the same thing, are saying, you know, we can say these things, and Netflix referred to the word guessing and guesswork being a word they don't want to use at the moment, because they're using it like they aren't using it lightly. It's when they say guesswork, they really mean guesswork. And while Snap didn't allude to that the same way, they probably are still saying the same thing. We don't know what the next few months are going to hold. We can assume that we're doing this, and this, but actually we've got no bloody idea what's going to happen. So we can just try and be positive about this, and not make you guys feel like, you know, your investment in this is going down the tube, but it probably will do to a certain degree. I think that Snap has always been a weird platform. They've always struggled with advertising. They've always struggled with verifying who their audience is and trying to maintain an older audience. And in this world, they're going to struggle with longevity on the platform and increased spent time on the platform, because there's not enough to really do on Snap versus you can get stuck in a video vortex on TikTok. You can get stuck messaging friends and family on Facebook and going through news feeds. TikTok, Snap doesn't have necessarily the same stickiness to it that the other platforms do. And that's where I think Snap's going to have problems. in the, it just continues in this new abnormal.
And it's interesting because they also made mention in that in the article on their Q1 results that actually they haven't done an awful lot in terms of product development in this quarter. And, you know, I wonder kind of what's happening in that regard, because they're clearly wanting to compete with those other major social platforms and the likes of Instagram. But, you know, so therefore, Brian, what's your point of view? Is this actually, you know, if we take into account what Lindsay's just said, my question sort of prior to that was, is this a platform that advertisers will look to, those that are looking to still spend in a climate like this? Lindsay's point of view is quite possibly not, because how valuable are those audiences? And as you've said, what's the audience volume anyway? Is it an attractive proposition?
Yeah, I mean, for many advertisers, it is. I mean, and let's also be mindful, you mentioned TikTok, they're one of the biggest advertisers on Snap.
Yeah, they are.
So that's, I think other developers have found that Snap is a very effective platform for their purposes. Yeah. The thing that I observed, and again, I've like to think I've maintained a reasonably solid objective view. And then I thought when the company came out, there was a lot of undue optimism at the time of the IPO. And you saw that in where they were able to price it, in absence of any real demonstration of how they would run a business. And that didn't mean there wasn't a there. The positivity that I could maintain around it, even when I was perceived as being so negative, was that, well, everyone who I trust that has a point of view on design skills says that Spiegel is a genius of design. I don't claim to be that expert myself, but you know, people I trust felt that strongly. And that was a basis to say, well, listen, the things that they're doing, that they're trying to do, they seem to, if they can actually execute on their vision, they're given the room to do it, they'll be fine. Just don't have undue expectations for where they'll end up. And, you know, part of the problem is that, you know, and unfortunately, this the same thing happened to Twitter as well, where they were able to generate a lot of demand from advertisers who were buying a bright, shiny object, arguably over-investing when the platform wasn't ready for them. And so I think that set a lot of the wrong expectations. The data that I have seen with respect to consumption of the platform, which I put some weight in, there's lots of reasons why you have to interpret it, but say from Nielsen or others, other attempts to quantify the usage has been favorable. Notwithstanding, you know, even in periods when a Kylie Jenner says, I'm not going to use the platform anymore, it actually still did fine from a usage perspective. They clearly had an issue from a technology perspective for a while, and they were focusing on the wrong things in some respects. They were ignoring markets like India. They were, you know, again, they were ignoring Android, and again, focused so much as they were on this design aesthetic and a certain expectation for bandwidth and all that. And I think that there was some management change there that probably freed up Spiegel as he matured very, very clearly as a leader. And you could see that they could start to realize whatever his vision was. And then you start to say, okay, they've retained most of the users and most of the usage. So now it's just a case of like, what are they going to do with it? And are they able to, you know, maintain relevance, generally speaking? Then do they create an environment for attention? One of the other things that's impressed me is that, you know, how engaged Spiegel's been with the advertising community. It's not something I would have expected 3 years ago. The opposite was definitely true at that time. What that means is I think he's getting a lot of exposure to what marketers want, balanced with what his vision is for what the platform should be. It's a pretty good setup for something that can be durable for the right kind of advertiser. Nobody should ever expect that this will be a ubiquitous platform that everybody will use. Now, again, if Discover was always the thing to pay attention to, because if they either were aggressive enough in investing in content directly or in persuading partners to invest aggressively enough in content, they could get audiences that would be very much acceptable to a TV-like advertiser. They hadn't done that really at enough scale yet. And as I was critiquing the numbers they provided, is to say they're still not there yet. That doesn't mean that it's not like legit inventory for someone looking for a certain kind of a niche audience or looking to fill in a plan or something. That advertiser exists. But the core of what they are is certainly, if you are a marketer who has a younger skewing audience, you want a certain kind of environment for your ads to run. Snap's a fine place to go. You just need to be mindful of its limitations.
Yeah. And I mean, I suppose it's interesting hearing you say there are a number of things that they are sort of yet to achieve, but they're, you know, potentially set up in order to achieve those. Let's see where this goes. Because this must be, you know, otherwise a quite a frustrating time to be a company in that position, since we just, everything we're dealing with from this moment onwards is somewhat unknown. So, you know, will they have sufficient sort of runway to carry them forward to a point where they can achieve what they want to achieve? What kind of a marketplace will they be in after all of this? All of those things are so unknown. So I guess we just have to wait and see.
Well, we actually know a fair amount. I mean, we know that Spiegel has complete unadulterated control, full stop. Right, from a legal perspective, and in terms of controlling the company, there is no one other than him and Bobby Murphy, I guess. But and so then the bigger constraint is, do they have capital and can they get capital? That's the bigger issue. If they, I mean, unfortunately, they're now, they again, another piece of positive news from the quarter was that they were cash flow positive from an operating perspective, aside from CapEx, and they are a CapEx light company. They need their scale to be cash flow positive. If they, all they did was they held on to this scale, in other words, they basically didn't decline this year, it probably wouldn't burn any cash. On the other hand, if they did decline in revenue, that would probably be very negative. Now, then the question is, do they have enough resources to make it to the next opportunity to raise more capital? Probably. And that's where they have, you know, that they can point to a lot of successes in the past. And again, they just have to hope they don't have any blowups. And then they maintain the latitude to operate as they always have. So that's the one constraint, that they it does take an awful lot of capital to run that company. And they are not they're not as well endowed as, say, a Facebook or a Google for those purposes.
Who is, really? Quite exceptions. Just on the, before we move on to the next news story, just back to the Netflix piece then as well. Brian, we spend quite a bit of time debating the whys and wherefores of Netflix's business model at Exchange Wire and on our Mad Tech podcasts. And we're often talking about whether they will develop an ad-funded model, quite possibly not in the US, but across their international markets. You mentioned, you know, that obviously strong streaming numbers in the US are responsible somewhat for their, you know, for Netflix's subscription growth. And I suppose we can wonder what that's going to look, what those sort of streaming, the numbers of people who are streaming are going to look like post lockdown. But it seems to me that if they've done so well at growing their sort of subscriber base for the time being in Europe and then perhaps also in APAC. But are we looking at a scenario where, and I'm very interested in your point of view on this too, Lindsay, are we looking at a scenario where that growth that we're seeing them getting a share of in international markets is principally potentially in households that are going to struggle to continue to pay for lots of different subscription services going forward? It's the age-old argument that we've sort of put forward from a European perspective versus a US perspective. Americans and North Americans are used to paying for TV-related content. Europeans are not. They tend to have a cap on their household budget of how much they're prepared to spend. Is there, therefore, an opportunity here for an ad-funded Netflix model, potentially outside the US? Brian, you first, and then Lindsay.
Unambiguously, never.
And so many people say this. Why never? Why never?
As long as...
In 2 minutes or less.
Management of the company is involved in the running of the company. They will never, 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 never have a conventional advertising model. That does not mean that there won't be money that we can broadly define as advertising, like, you know,
product placements. Yeah.
But there will never be a conventional ad model. It is just anathema to what they believe in as a product, as an offering. And if you want it, great, good for you. And if you don't want it, sorry, come back, get a free trial. Hey, borrow someone's password if you need to. They'd rather that than if you must get it for free. Okay. And so I think it's a cultural issue that drives it. I'd also push back on the idea that, you know, Americans weren't always used to paying for content, or Canadians or others. I mean, I think that that's something that started on a widespread basis a few decades ago. But I think that, as someone reminded me, 2 weeks of expense on the tube is equivalent to a year's subscription to Netflix. So I think people can find the money to pay for it from lots of places.
Yeah, I can completely see what you mean there, except for that. So you might not have always been used to paying for content, but you've become used to it, and you therefore have a threshold for it now. You're right. There are many things that are expensive in Europe, but a lot of people would see the tube as a necessity because that's how they get to work, as opposed to,
but you're not commuting for the next year and a half.
At the moment, exactly, at the moment. But that might not go on forever. And that's, you know, supposing they've got jobs. Lindsay, what are you saying?
Also, the tube argument, I would say, you know, that's very London. And while London is a large proportion of the population of the UK, the rest of the UK are definitely not used to paying for content in that sense. They're used to still using getting Freeview installed on their smart TV. And before that, even having a Freeview box, so all their channels are free of charge. So paying money to get content is just not a thing that the majority of the UK are really used to doing. And obviously, we're seeing
Sky's done okay.
Huh?
Sky's done okay.
Oh, Sky's done brilliantly. And so Sky's done brilliantly, Virgin's done brilliantly, but also Freeview is very, very popular and will remain popular as long as it's available. Because with Freeview, you get 100 channels or more in some cases, depending on and there's a lot of content there that many people just don't feel they need to pay for Sky or pay for Now TV, which is obviously the streaming version of it, or pay for anything else. But I think that then cable will still always probably be a part of UK life, as well as streaming platforms. There's this notion in the US of cord cutters, cord nevers, cord shavers, which is we're sort of trying to adopt in the UK as well as phraseology. But we're still very, very far behind with the US in terms of numbers on that, as far as I'm aware. But I think as well, talking about kind of the ad funding side of Netflix, I think what we've always talked about, Rachel, was kind of how Netflix will tackle APAC, because APAC's always been a really interesting region for streaming. And you look at the likes of iFlix, and they've had to go ad funded because they realise that there just isn't the money there for people to pay for subscriptions for streaming services. And Netflix obviously are trying to combat that. And they've launched in Southeast and South Asia, they've launched the mobile offering to allow their customers that they appreciate are largely mobile focused and mobile users, because that's what the majority of usage is in those countries, with a heavily reduced price. I think it starts from like $3 a month, which is nothing compared to what we pay for the full access. So we believed that in APAC, Netflix would launch an ad-funded model because that was the way to get around that market. But actually what they've just done is just slash the price.
That's more culturally consistent. That this is my point, that if Reed Hastings wasn't there, sure. But if Reed Hastings wasn't there, I think you've got a whole lot of other things to think about. But it's just, it's absolutely, like, and they know they've got a problem in India, because Hotstar is going to be, it is ad supported, and they want to have that scale, but they know they can't. And that's a trade-off they're willing to make, because they know that they would be a very different company if they had any meaningful element of their business that was traditionally ad support, or even a minor element that was ad support. It would change how they made decisions. And the capital markets, for example, again, we can quibble about the right valuation, but I mean, and there's sort of a point of proof that if you have a clear view about what you want to do, Wall Street and the city will take a long-term view too. They want to be woefully optimistic. And if you keep performing against some long-term vision, capital's available. And so they keep doing it. They keep succeeding because they're true to what they want to be. Mm. And the fact that they can raise debt is objectively ridiculous. And yet it's no problem. That they can, and they will, they'll be cash flow positive soon. But the fact that they aren't even cash flow positive this far into their development is amazing in some respects, and that they're worth more than Disney.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much more that we could debate on this, but I'm going to move us on to the second news story of the week. And I guess this is somewhat related, because one of the points you just made there, Brian, is interesting. You are categorical about saying they won't enter into a traditional ad-funded model, but, you know, advertising by way of either product placements or sponsorship could be something a little different. And so that's kind of related somewhat to the second news story of the week, which is a good piece covered in DigiDay, reporting on BMW spending quite significant sums in esports. Now, we've been chatting about esports for the last couple of weeks on the Mad Tech podcast because there's quite a spike in viewing numbers with the absence of live sports and with an overall uptick in gaming and game-related content anyways, channeling quite a lot of people towards esports. So I found this article interesting because it talks about BMW spending effectively marketing dollars. So this is not sponsorship money. This is marketing dollars, advertising dollars on esports exposure and looking at that as an investment in the potential sort of future, I suppose, brand visibility for what they categorize as a classic esports audience. So if you're thinking that mostly an esports audience is a younger audience and they're not necessarily purchasing cars, BMW are looking at this as a kind of long-term strategy. And they're also saying that they're looking at it not through the lens of traditional advertisements and traditional ad placements, but rather on content, and where they're looking to see the results is through sort of social media and fan engagement channels. So I thought this was interesting because I wonder what it says about what that kind of content marketing and advertising offering might look like, particularly in an esports environment. And whether this is also an indication that some traditional brands, although they're outrightly saying, we know this is a younger audience, but we just want to be front of mind when they're older and when they come to purchase cars. But are we actually starting to see that these bigger traditional brands are being convinced of the value of these audiences, which I would argue are probably not just Gen Zs. There's probably a lot of them, but we might start to see that audience kind of fan out a little bit more as esports becomes a more sort of routinely consumed channel. Let's switch it up. I'm going to go to you first, Lindsay, and then back to Brian.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we've talked about esports and gaming in general on this podcast a lot over the past few weeks, particularly as its rapid rise during the pandemic is evident for all to see. But I think the BMW branding element is a very interesting one. It obviously ties in with BMW have been doing this forever as part of the marketing strategy, is going and finding these younger audiences that they will market to for 25 years until they're ready to buy a car. Rolex do it, Jaguar do it, and they used to go to like the magazines and whatever and be big, shiny, glossy, and obviously they... sponsorship, we talked about, they'll sponsor kind of the big auto racing like Formula One, those kind of brands that attract a lot of these younger audiences, and they know they will not buy for a long time. They're wanting to kind of be the aspirational brand for them for decades to come. So when they are ready and earning big bucks, that's the brand they'll go for. BMW have worked with me, so I could attest to it. But in terms of esports, it's what's interesting is that BMW have obviously done a lot of research into, okay, where are our audience? Do we believe this audience will be buying cars when they're ready to buy a car? And what I've noticed is a lot of BMW brand advertising at the moment, and there's a lot of automotive advertising still out there, which might surprise some people, but at the end of this, when people can go drive around again and there'll be a lot of stock to get rid of, there'll be a lot of cars to buy at cheap deals, but also the BMW ads I'm seeing specifically are all about their electric range. So I think that in what they are doing, going after this Gen Z audience, they probably won't be going after them trying to turn them into petrol heads. They'll be going after them, trying to turn them into this eco generation. They probably believe the esports Gen Z generation is going to be an eco generation that will be looking for sustainability. So they'll probably be going after them with these new models that in 25 years' time will be what the world is using, rather than trying to sell them the latest M3 model.
Yeah. Interesting. What do you think, Brian? Surprising or not surprising that BMW are putting their ad dollars here?
Well, I don't have much said on BMW specifically. I can say that the interest in esports has absolutely risen. And I think it's because, frankly, there's a lot of desperate marketers who were depending on sports, looking for any acceptable alternative first. And I think there are a lot of interesting ideas out there, you know, like getting the actual athletes to play themselves, that sort of thing, in a game that people will watch, absolutely. Question is how many and how frequently and how broad is that audience? And that's actually the thing I've been most interested in. I don't know there's been enough deep diving into, because the data doesn't really exist. How much consumption is there among what percentage of the population with what frequency, right? I mean, I think I've seen some data, it's irregular and it's certainly not third party, therefore more trustworthy data. So that's the bigger problem I have. Intuitively, you would expect that there would be more consumption, yes, and more people who might be casual consumers who would access it. And so that you could realistically expect to reach people in esports. But the specifics, it's hard to comment without specific data to focus on, and I'm not aware of good specific data.
Yeah, I think this will be stuff that will be being closely observed, right, at the moment, because suddenly everybody's eyes are being turned towards the world of esports, and we'll all be sort of hungry for those data points.
Yeah. There isn't data. I mean, this is one problem with the esports industry, is that the data is severely lacking, and it's been able to get away with it for a long time. But now I think as brands, BMW have obviously gone in there, probably done their research, but will not have much third-party data to go on in terms of guessing where their audience is. And as more brands want to start looking at esports as their next big area to advertise, they're going to want more data points. So the industry in general, there are companies out there that will share anecdotal numbers, like Newzoo is a big company that people rely on, but Newzoo themselves get their data from various arbitrary sources. So again, it's not that reliable, and they'll probably admit that themselves. I think that there'll be more and more demand for numbers. So how the esports industry will reconcile that will be an interesting one.
Yep. And do you think that this is potentially a bit of a segue to the notion of this, you know, advertising budget, so not a sponsorship budget, but an advertising budget being spent in an area that isn't traditional advertising placements? Are we going to start to see some advertisers get a bit more comfortable with devoting budgets to that type of activity, whether it's, you know, product placements or whether it's kind of product giveaways, those sorts of things? Are we going to start to see brands perceive that as advertising budget worthy?
I mean, to some degree, yeah. I mean, but something becomes an advertising supportable medium. Certainly for starters, if consumers are engaging with that with a meaningful amount of time, if the marketer wants to borrow the brand equity, and if consumers effectively give permission. I mean, we could have conversations like this, and, you know, the three of us could have like some sort of, we can see each other on Zoom here, and maybe I could have like a banner on my forehead that was constantly changing a commercial message. Theoretically, that work as a medium.
I think you're onto something.
I know.
I mean, I think you've just given us a little bit of a potential business model there, Brian.
But I think that, you know, obviously that's not something that we would deem socially acceptable. I think it's safe to say. But for the if you could persuade, that said, if you could persuade the population that something is appropriate to have ads around it, and it takes a bit of experimentation to figure out what that is, then sure, anything can be an ad medium, ad supported medium.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. Like what we've just accepted to be normal for a long time is probably about to change across many different channels, really. Okay, I'm going to bring us on to our third story for the day, which is a little bit left field. It's only really got a loose connection to the world of ad tech in terms of I suppose, location data. It's a story about, on the topic of people doing okay in Q1, it's a story about Chinese telecoms group Huawei reporting a 1.4% increase in their Q1 sales to $25.7 billion. And I raise it because, you know, Huawei's been all over the news really since late last year, for missing their, you know, projected revenue numbers and putting that down to the standoff that they're having with the US government over sanctions relating to components that are manufactured in the US, which they use for their hardware. So here's a story about them, doing quite well from a revenue point of view, despite those sanctions. And I suppose it's caused me to want to have a conversation with you two about where we see their marketplace going forward in the next sort of, you know, quarter or so. They've got quite a diversified business. They sell handsets, but they also provide infrastructure. They've got some, you know, they've got a pretty high volume of contracts to be providing 5G infrastructure across a number of commercial networks. What is that business going to look like going forward? And I suppose what's particularly interesting about this article is that it noted that, you know, they were Huawei were pressed for comment on whether they would be providing any location data from their mobile phone handsets to the Chinese government for the purposes of contact tracing relating to COVID-19, to which they explicitly said no and said that, you know, unlike Google and Apple, they don't develop apps and they don't use their customer data in this fashion. So I kind of just wanted to have a little bit of chat, bit of a chat between us about what we all think about that. You know, we've had many interesting conversations, as I'm sure the rest of the world has, about the differences between life in Asia and life in the West ever since COVID-19 reared its head. But also it's something we talk about a lot from a business perspective at ExchangeWire as well. It's what marketplaces in Asia look like in comparison to marketplaces elsewhere. And I just thought this was a helpful segue into that discussion, and it'd be great to get your perspective, Brian, since you're based over there in the US, and we'll no doubt have a North American point of view on what Huawei is doing with their business.
Well, I'd like to think I have a global view. It's a British and American passport holder, but I will say that you know, the telecom equipment business. This is a business I know well enough to know that I don't know what I don't know. What I can suggest with respect to this situation specifically is that, you know, and I think I see commonality between the Huawei situation and Western governments and the relationship that, say, Facebook and Google have with many of those same governments and the societies in general. In the latter two companies' cases, this is a time where there's a reset or potential for a reset. In that, if you can be helpful, you probably have a shot at pitching whatever you've got to sell or whatever proposition you have. And I don't think that the underlying merits of concerns that stakeholders note, I'm keeping this general because I think this applies to a lot of different topics. The concerns that stakeholders have remain. And I think as long as anyone is mindful, who's trying to pitch something or sell something, is mindful of what those concerns were and they adapt, they've got a shot at just resetting. I see that in terms of geopolitical relationships. I see that in terms of, you know, companies that have fraught political relationships with various governments. And the same can be true with brands and consumers. So I don't know how this specifically, you know, how telecom equipment plays out. But I do think that to the extent that we're trying to anticipate how governments will respond to issues that they've put out there, as relating to you know, national security or otherwise, I think that in a very general sense, I mean, again, look at China and the sort of the goodwill with masks, you know, that they probably have developed, assuming the masks work, right? Mostly, but even like with Canada, where, you know, relations have never been worse. I mean, their Canadian-Chinese relations have been absolutely horrific for the last few years, and yet there's definitely signs of attempts to create goodwill between those governments. And now, in part for Canada, it's because they've started to realize that maybe they can't rely on the United States in the way that they were counting on, and in part other countries might be looking at it the same way. If you're China, you're thinking, well, this is an opportunity for us. And so there is a chance for a reset on a lot of those elements that you're pointing to.
Yeah. Lindsay, what do you think? Like Brian says, an opportunity for a reset in relations between Huawei and the US government and maybe, you know, Chinese companies and international governments. And also I'm interested in your point of view on their point about, you know, use of customer data, even if it is for the purposes of good, as it may be for a contact tracing scheme. Yeah. What do you think, Lindsay?
Yeah, I think the opportunity for a reset would be amazing. I think that there are many opportunities from company to company relationships to government relationships that could do with a bit of a reset, but I'm not necessarily sure that China will be involved in many of them. It's just, I don't necessarily think from in many cases it's even China's fault. It's just the way that the global politics has been and will continue to be, but that I don't know enough about it to really kind of comment on that. But I think that, as Brian said, kind of if you're able to do good, now is the chance to take advantage of what good you can do. And we are seeing that with many companies. And I think that we talked about this from a location data perspective a few weeks ago. There will be companies out there that can do good with location data, but there's this line crossing of what does good mean when it comes to people's personal location data. You know, it's understanding what this is PII, understanding how it can be used, understanding how it could be used and how it should be used. They are all very, very different things. And getting each individual user to be educated to understand how that data is being used for their benefit and how the government will use it for the benefit of the greater good, for the benefit of the health of their nation, versus to keep tabs on their nation. And that is people, people look at China and worry that that's what they're going to be doing. It's a great, you know, there was someone said the other day, autocrats love a pandemic because it gives them a chance to take reign supreme over their country, put them all on lockdown, and then basically track every single thing that they're doing and where they are. And any democratic country will look at that with fear.
100%. Brian, were you going to come in on that?
Just going to add, I mean, if companies adapt what they're doing to reflect the concerns that previously existed, they've got something viable.
Yeah.
And it is, and I wonder, Brian, from your perspective, is there any sort of sense of suspicion from, you know, when governments talk about sort of, you know, Google and Apple collaborating to provide, you know, infrastructure to the government for contact tracing purposes, are people suspicious of that? Or in the US?
I mean, I think your read will be as good as mine. But I think that all of us can have a point of view, and it's hard to really know. My guess is that, again, people will be willing to submit data for these purposes if they're clear about why the data is being used. I mean, go back to the premise behind GDPR, right? I mean, it's basically you have to explain why you need the data and basically promise that you're not going to misuse it.
Yeah.
And it's the right spirit to think about data. And then the other piece to remember, and I made this argument with respect to GDPR, that if you can't persuade a customer or consumer to part with their data, maybe you don't deserve it.
Absolutely. And we've talked extensively about how, for example, the ad tech industry has done a really poor job of articulating the value that they bring and what it is that they're trying to do with people's data. And that also reminds me of what, you know, many people that we've chatted to in the APAC marketplace, people I know who've lived in China, Singaporeans who speak very highly perhaps of the way that their government arranges things. And the premise is it's not just sort of, you know, giving over their data without a second thought. It's the idea that they understand what the value exchange is. So they give their data over and they firmly believe they're getting something of value and of use back, and that that's a respected transaction. And I guess, you know, you could
but just... It's not if you end up feeling as a consumer that your democracy is overturned because of it, and that becomes...
Exactly. I was about to say, I guess we can have this debate from two different sides of a political coin. And that could take us into all sorts of, tangent territories. So let's get back to core Mad Tech podcast stuff and have a little bit of a chat, Brian, about what you're up to at GroupM. Impressive wallpaper that you've got there. We'll be taking a little photograph afterwards so everyone will get the pleasure of seeing Brian's house kitted out in his GroupM wallpaper. So maybe talk a little bit about what you're focusing on at GroupM. I feel like it wasn't that long ago that you joined, but it's got to be maybe 2 years?
No, just over a year.
Okay.
February of last year. Since really mid-late January, it's been all pandemic all the time. And by that, I mean, there's so much that it impacts, obviously, and it's meant that from becoming like an amateur epidemiologist to I can claim to be an applied economist sort of and I don't have formal training in economics. That's the only distinction I make, but I am a financial analyst by training. But applying that to, you know, assessing the global economy, and you can't assess the global economy unless you have a view about how the pandemic plays out, and looking at how different markets have performed and looking at different governments responded and how they haven't. And that's a big chunk of time looking what then, now that we are in earnings season, I'm going into way more detail than I otherwise would in terms of, you know, how individual companies are faring. Because we're learning so much. Like in 5 or 6 weeks of time, it's 5 or 6 years of change, and so it's dense information access. And then on top of that, you know, I've been working remotely from Portland, Oregon for a long time. I mean, my prior role, most of my clients were New York or London, and I was out here. And now in a global organization, albeit one that's, again, New York and London centric, it makes no difference where I am. And so I'm certainly engaging with colleagues and clients far more than I ever would have.
Oh, that's interesting. And that's because they're a bit more attuned into engaging with you in a remote capacity, and before they would have sort of insisted that you be there in person, or?
Well, I would put it this way. First of all, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And I've only ever claimed to have one eye. So maybe others had two eyes from the beginning, and now I kept my one eye throughout. Awesome, useful. I don't know. So there's definitely an element of like, what I know is nice to know in good times, but need to know at this point in time. So there's that. And then, yeah, the fact is that, I think if there was an expectation that I would physically be somewhere to be part of a meeting, that just wasn't going to happen because, frankly, I couldn't get any work done if I was traveling all the time.
Yeah.
Not that I didn't travel, but I couldn't travel as much as, you know, I'm not going to be on the road 250 days a year. And now I can actually be physically in different places 250 days a year at this point or more.
Like, well, especially if you're getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, as you confessed earlier on. That was
the norm before too. That was not.
But I mean, at least that enables you to catch a good chunk of a European work day as well on the same day, right? Yeah.
And then the afternoons for Asia.
Yeah. That's really interesting insight. And then I find your updates really useful and helpful. The one that you released earlier on this week, which was focusing on how consumer behavior will change post pandemic, but more specifically the ways in which people are going to spend their time and what impact that's going to have on, I suppose, the business world, the world of spending, the world of marketing, and the world of advertising. Say a little bit more about that. You raised some really good points. The whole notion of people, you know, not only will we go through this phase of being locked down as we currently are, and then being sort of in some kind of transition to, those lockdown measures being sort of eased, and then potentially to back to normal, but we don't really know what that normal is going to look like. Beyond all of that, there's going to be, you know, a significant proportion of time spent at home, much more than ever before. And maybe that's also going to cause us to think in general about the ways in which we live our lives, and in the long run, spend more time at home. I think that's probably a reasonable perspective, right? And you also made a point about sort of small gatherings versus large gatherings, quite likely that we're all going to be herded into an environment where we're spending much more time in small gatherings and large gatherings. Basically an introvert's delight, this new world, I would say.
Well, I think you characterized it well. In the interest of time, may I suggest go to groupm.com to read it.
Yeah. Very good. Thanks very much, Brian. Okay, well, that brings us to the end of this week's Mad Tech podcast. Thank you very much for joining us, bright and early from Portland, Oregon. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. That was the Mad Tech podcast.